Joe Spisak from Reflection AI. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
Reflection AI, first of all, it's a very cool name. We love it. This name is really, it feels like a familiar name, right? And the company is sort of new, started in 2024, came out of stealth in 2025. Yeah. You joined rather recently, right? Coming from Meta. Yeah. And you've been there since March, right? But would you mind going over what Reflection AI does? We know we're going to talk a lot about open source and open weights and everything, but would you tell our listeners what Reflection AI does?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, yes, I guess while I joined in March, I was a longtime advisor and angel in the company. So it was actually kind of a funny story on how I met the founders. I met them probably almost 2 years ago, actually. And they had first started the company out of DeepMind. And because, if you know, the founders, Giannis, for example, was one of the founders of DeepMind, working with Demis over there and leading the RL side. So AlphaGo, AlphaGo Zero, those kind of projects, he was working on those. And Misha was working on Gemini and reward modeling. And they kind of came together. Actually, Misha, the CEO, actually reported to Giannis at Google. So, you know, pretty interesting dynamic there. But they, somebody over in FAIR, in our research org in Meta, had introduced us, and I was kind of, I almost didn't even take the meeting when I was introduced. I'm glad I did. Because I get a lot of inbound for folks wanting me to invest and advise. I just don't have the bandwidth to do it all. But I met them and I was really impressed. I was impressed with their product sense, impressed with their general demeanor, how they saw the space, how thoughtful they were. And it was a great conversation. And you know, when you advise, you sort of vote with your time, you vote with your calendar and your feet, right? And I just found myself, every Friday, I tend to be an early person. I start working around 5 a.m. And so every Friday, roughly at 6 a.m., we'd spend an hour together, like me and Giannis and Misha. And they would just walk me through the latest research, show me evals. I get to play with some of their early, prototypes of what they were building. And it just kind of grew into a really, really fun, really cool relationship. And I ended up spending more and more time. And I think when they pivoted over to building, frontier open weight models, it was kind of right in the center of an area of passion for me. And I think it was because they had offered me multiple times to join as CPO of the company. And I was really pretty happy with what I was doing at Meta and the latitude and the freedom I had and the impact that I was having. And I think, at some point it just kind of made sense. It was like, this is exactly what I wanted to go do. And they're well-funded and the research team is fantastic. And it just made a lot of sense. And so I kind of pulled the trigger and ended up joining, really this year. So, a little bit about Reflection. It is first and foremost, it is a frontier lab. It's a bunch of researchers kind of composed of Anthropic, OpenAI, Meta, Google, DeepMind, and others. And our goal is basically to build open frontier intelligence and enable really anyone to own their own intelligence, whether that's a sovereign nation who is building an AI factory that they want to serve, like we have with Shinsegae in Korea, where, there's going to be end users of that factory, like big companies within Korea that will be able to use the tokens that come out of that factory and build their own intelligence, build their own products, build their own agents, down to, the developers and the ecosystem and the open source, community and ecosystem, where I've spent a lot of my career kind of building those communities and building those ecosystems. And so it's truly a company with a very singular mission. Everyone's behind it. It's pretty interesting to see all the cultures kind of come together, because, OpenAI and Anthropic and Google and Meta and these companies have very different cultures, and people have kind of very different ways of doing things. But what I'm finding is this melting pot of different companies or different people from these companies are melting. When you have a common mission that people get behind, like, none of that other stuff ends up mattering. So it's actually pretty exciting.
And it has this very different, as far as I know, way of working, that you'll have the open models sort of like aimed at the final public, right?
Yep.
Which will be the result of the company being funded through government contracts and enterprise contracts, right? So I was thinking, and since you have such a vast experience with product, is the product the open source models? Is the product... is the government sort of like the side gig for the company? Is it both? How do you see the company going forward?
Yeah, I think the fact that it's open source, I think is a critical aspect of things. It's not what it's very hard to sell open source. There's a lot of companies out there that, if you look at Databricks, like, they were built on Spark. If you look at, the Jan Stoica, kind of army of startups building on a lot of open platforms. It is difficult. You can do it, certainly. And Databricks is probably the shining example. You know, maybe the Hadoop companies in the early days of like Cloudera and Hortonworks and so on. But ultimately, you know, open weights are important because, you know, control and autonomy of or agency over your intelligence, I think, is the most important piece here. You know, we're monetizing really the full stack and a lot more. And I think that's the piece that's important for our company. It's not, you know, the weights are strategic in that it's the intelligence layer that powers everything else, you know, but the whole stack and kind of what we're building and examples of that, for example, like are the, you know, the Shinsegae Korea deal, where it is a full, you know, AI factory, all the way from like the land and power, all the way to building agents and enabling that country and companies, large enterprises within that country to kind of own their intelligence. They can customize it. They can deploy it. They can own the cost, which is getting insanely high right now. If you go to any of the API providers, like you're like, oh my God, I can't, like it's, and those things can be kind of pulled out from under you at any moment or nerfed. And I think that's, you know, when you're a big corporation or, you know, you're an enterprise, you're a financial institution or a healthcare institution, it's really, really hard to build on something that you don't actually control or have agency over or can customize to your needs. And I think that's where we come in. I think we start with foundation models that are open source or that are open, the weights are open, and we're building an operating system around them that can then be basically leveraged by these organizations. And we obviously help them deploy these things. But it is ultimately about not only shipping a set of weights, but an ecosystem around those weights. And I think that's like the really exciting part for me personally. So
it's really interesting you say that. And it really comes close to my heart because I work here in Barcelona in the research center, the Barcelona Supercomputing Center in Spain. And we're trying to do that, like trying to create open source models, open weight models, and train with open data, everything. Like we're trying to do something not exactly the same, but to a governmental level, something that resonates a lot with your mission. So kudos for that, for trying to do this in the US as well. And when we speak about this, like you were one of the most relevant, most important open models. You were behind the Llama team. You're leading them there. And this is amazing. People still use and still talk about Llama 3.1, for example, 3.3. And I want to touch first the success. So like, how was your part in developing and promoting all of this for the Llama 3 family of models that everyone and their moms were using? And also, if I can get into the controversy a bit as well, what came up for Llama 4 a bit later that was not a success? I understand there was a little, probably a lot of pressure from many areas in the company there at Meta.
Yeah.
But like, what was the real thing? Because we only get what the media told us, and now you're here and you can tell your side of the story as well.
Yeah, I need to be a little careful on the latter. No, Llama 3 was, you know, I think this is a big reason, I kind of alluded to this earlier, a big reason why, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing here, Reflection. Is because I was so passionate about what we did with Llama 3. And, you know, I came back from Google right before Llama 2 shipped. And, you know, I saw what happened with Llama 2, and it was a good model and a perfect time to ship it. And we grew the ecosystem around Llama 2. And then leading up to Llama 3, when we built out the multilingual capabilities, we built out the multimodal capabilities and image reasoning and so on. And just seeing kind of what opening up the intelligence layer did for developers, what it did for enterprises, what it did for startups, was so impactful. And, you know, if you had never worked in a research lab, if you've never worked with a frontier research team, if you never shipped models, you know, into the ecosystem or into production, I highly recommend it. You should do it because it's stressful. It's intense. You know, it's more cross-functional. I mean, I was in the AI space, or I have been in the AI space for almost 13 years now. And like, it is the most cross-functional thing that you'll ever probably do, because it's, you know, when I first started in the AI space, unfortunately we didn't call it AI at the time, but, you know, it was deep learning and it was kind of like, you know, CNNs or these convolutional neural nets that we were building and shipping, and then, you know, NLP models or LSTMs. And, you know, we didn't have, like, let's say, the level of scrutiny or the level of engagement from policy and legal and, you know, and just the impact and the potential risks that we're dealing with at this point in time with this technology. They just weren't there. I mean, we saw risks certainly, but it wasn't like this. So I think, you know, my experience with Llama was just how cross-functionally you had to think how and collaborate. We had people from all over the company, upwards to leadership, to privacy, legal, like I said, dealing with the policy side of things. You know, when you have powerful technology that you're releasing, you need to think about everything truly end to end, from what data you're training on, how you think about privacy, how you think about things like how you red team it, how you think about safety thresholds, how you think about the ecosystem itself and how you release, how you license the technology, where you deploy it, who are your distribution partners, how you collaborate on end products. Like it is such a complex thing, but yet at the same time, so much fun. And, I was very, very excited. As crazy as it was like one of the most impactful products or projects I've worked on probably in my career. And again, that's why I'm probably doing what I'm doing now, because, you get to be a little bit of an adrenaline junkie when it comes to shipping things into the ecosystem, and you see what happens when you get this into people's hands, and it's wild. You learn so much. I would say like one of the things that I've learned over my career, especially in the last, 10, 15 years, is you can learn so much faster if you build in the open. It's like such a thing that's obvious to a lot of people, but until you really say it and internalize it, like think about safety. We talk about safety, Anthropic talks about safety. We all talk about, have worked on the safety side of things. If you get your model and you get your technology in the hands of literally millions of people globally, you will learn so much faster. And you can improve your technology so much faster. You can give people guardrails and artifacts that they can then customize and build on. And you can then learn again from them. And it was like the premise of PyTorch. Like, why do we do PyTorch? Like, why would Meta open source and build PyTorch? Well, at the time, actually, I think you mentioned, Barcelona, like one of my good friends is Christian Canton, who's over there in your world. Over there.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah, he's my boss.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, cool. Yeah. So yeah, Christian Canton and I actually worked on safety, and we worked on safety on Llama. And he was leading integrity actually at Meta, Facebook previously, and working with me. And like one of the original ideas or the premise we had, one of them anyway, for PyTorch was, back in the day when people were building CNNs, like every week at the time, there was a new CNN architecture that was coming out. And we built we're building PyTorch, and we were building this lingua franca with the research community. And when they would release a new model, remember like ResNet, ResNext, all these different architectures that kept pushing accuracy up. I mean, literally on a weekly basis, we'd get these new architectures and we'd retrain, and we'd actually push our integrity models up in accuracy. So things like hateful memes and nudity and all the kind of like toxic content that we were trying to filter off the platform, like the more accurate we could get our classifiers to be, obviously the better, Facebook was for people. And so when we saw that like everyone was building on PyTorch, we really doubled down, and it allowed us to basically leverage that ecosystem so much faster to accelerate internally. So instead of like just having this like narrow research team that's trying to figure out, how to build a better, more accurate CNN, we saw like this community around us do it, a lot of it for us. And we could really like draft off of what they were doing. And that actually accelerated our 1P, our internal integrity work that, again, like Christian was leading over here. So I carry that same mentality through a lot of the things we're doing in terms of, Llama, or what we did with Llama. Like if you looked at what we did with like Llama 2, when we shipped that model, one of the reasons why we pushed hard to release the base pre-train weights is I really wanted to understand how the post-training ecosystem was going to evolve. That was a thesis I had, because you could easily hold those back and say, well, you can't really safety red team, base weights, right? They're not aligned. Like they're not really like coherent. Like we shouldn't release them. Well, my thesis was, if you get them in the hands of Stanford and Noose Research and some of the really smart folks out there in the ecosystem, they will find better ways to align them, new techniques. And you saw even within, I think, a matter of days, the Stanford folks actually, they released the Alpaca models, yep, which were even better aligned than what we had released. Like within a few days, we're like, oh my God, this is mind blowing. Like this is incredible. And Noose did a bunch, and Berkeley released Vicuna. And like, it was just like the explosion of innovation was happening in post-training. We were learning so fast. And I think that kind of proves the premise, I would say, that, or the thesis I would say that I had.
And we're speaking at a very interesting time. And I think that reflection AI is at the crux of many subjects that are sort of like converging, because we're recording this interview right after Fable 5 was back allowed to be made available throughout the world, right? There was this interview with with Alex Karp from Palantir, which made reverberations as well, as Palantir was talking about AI sovereignty on the heels of their deal with NVIDIA, which stirred the pot a little bit. Yep. And in this sort of like modern era of LLMs, there were two, I think, defining moments for open source. One of them was Llama. The other one was DeepSeek. And it sort of pitted the US against China with this, should we be open or closed? What are the advantages of each?
Yeah.
And everything is happening right now as the other countries are going to be like, wait, if you have this model that can be swept away from us without any notice, maybe open source could be the way to go, right? But you're in the US doing open source. How do you see this entire market? I know that you can't predict the future, but it's pointing towards what, like in this open source adoption through companies and governments?
Yeah, I think what's interesting, I guess from my perspective, maybe I'm a bit controversial in probably saying this, but I actually think the Chinese labs actually have done a really great job in open source. I think the DeepSeek team, they released obviously their initial models. There was this, there was a bit of a reset in the market in terms of expectations on compute efficiency and all that. And they did a lot of work, I would say, at the lowest levels, especially at the PyTorch level and actually at the NVIDIA library level, to get efficiencies. Were the numbers overblown? Absolutely, in terms of being able to train a foundation model cheaply. But still, what they did was actually quite impressive. And then they started to release, if you remember, there were the 12 days of DeepSeek where they released a lot of low-level components. There was the comms collective kernels they released, algorithms for distributed training. I was really pretty impressed with what they released. Was it state-of-the-art, some of it? No. Was it really cool to see the transparency and what they had built and have them put out things that kind of geeks like me in terms of low-level or full-stack AI, really resonated with? Yes, I really loved digging into it. I think there's what we're realizing though, as a country, in terms of US or the West, is again, you don't ship just a model, you do ship an ecosystem. And when that ecosystem starts to kind of rally around you, and there starts to become this gravity around your model. And I think that can be everything from the libraries and the things that get built on top of it, whether it's agent harnesses, whether it's the low level kernels and what hardware you get bound to. When you release weights, what ends up happening is, I mean, yes, when we have a deep partnership with NVIDIA and we're going to release weights that obviously support NVIDIA hardware, but the ecosystem very quickly rallies around you and supports other hardware. And I think that ecosystem starts to form. And I think what you're seeing with, say, the Chinese weights is they're starting to gravitate towards a very Chinese ecosystem. And that, can be challenging, right? It creates a lot of, inertia within it. If you use the weights, it creates some inertia to that ecosystem, which can be risky. And I think that's what people are starting to realize is the weights, you can call them on one hand commodity, but at the same time, they're also very strategic. In the layer that they are in the stack. And then the next layer, of course, the next battlefront that is formed is around the harness. It's I hear end users and I hear, companies saying, I'm not being sold a model anymore. I'm being sold a harness. Because that harness also has a certain amount of, stickiness to it. Again, it's a little bit paradoxical because you have the harness is considered commodity, but at the same time, it's sticky and it's strategic. And so I think these layers, you're moving further and further up. And again, it becomes this ecosystem that you're buying into. And I think that it's important to take that into account. And it's not just a model layer fight anymore. It's quickly gone up the stack to the agent layer. And now you're seeing these mixture of agents, type of harnesses that bring together multiple agents. And it's the same paradigm that we've had, honestly, for many years in terms of when we took multiple models and we did joint inference and we would do these multi-model systems where we blend these blend them together and find the word is eluding me right now, but when we bring multiple models, now we're basically blending multiple agents to get better results. And it's expensive. And obviously, like, things will get cheaper and cheaper as you use more and more open source models. And the ecosystem around distillation continues to evolve and take these models and bring them into smaller form factors, lower precision numerics, lowers the cost of deploying them. More systems become available with these models. You can then basically leverage them. And when they are open weight, you can then inspect the system. Then you have observability. You know, you can layer your own safety on and so on. So
you're saying basically that your main, let's put it as competitors, but not in a bad way, just like competitors in the market that many companies exist and they coexist, actually.
Yep.
It are the Chinese labs like DeepSeek or Minimax, Alibaba Quinn and all that,
yep,
rather than OpenAI and Anthropic and Google. Interesting. And do you think you are a threat to the closed labs?
I mean, I think to be honest, I don't see... I mean, the ecosystem is pretty complex. I mean, I do think that there is room for open and closed. I've never seen a world where it is really one or the other. I do think ultimately also the open weights need to be hosted too. And I think that, you know, a lot of how you're going to see open weights used in the future, you know, if you look at even like GLM 5.2, which is a great model, like on paper, but also like in practice, it's a really good model. It's a 756, I think, billion parameter model, which is, you know, not something that anyone can kind of host themselves. It's very expensive. Ultimately, you're going to use it, you know, via something like OpenRouter, or you're going to, you know, it's going to be hosted somewhere and it's going to look and feel a lot like a closed model at the end of the day. What you actually get though, in that case, you get somewhere in between. You get something where you can actually get like zero data retention as a result of it being hosted, which is actually really powerful, you know, for companies. And I think I see it more of a continuum in a lot of ways versus just like kind of like one or the other. But I do think like companies, like there's going to be a, you know, a world where open and closed coexist. Like if you want the, you know, the iOS type, you know, fully managed, like trust in Apple, like ecosystem, that's fine. You buy into that. It's like, it's really up to you as a company, what you need and what your capabilities are. If you want the more, hey, I can have full agency. I have the team that can go and customize this, you know, zero data retention or my ability to fully own, and manage things, or I'm in a regulated industry, or I have a different business model or whatever it is. Like, I think open source really enables a lot more flexibility in that regard. And I think that flexibility is going to be important for a lot of companies. I think that you look at the ecosystem and developers, like they want that flexibility. They want to be able to own it. Like you can't, for example, like tinker with the tokenizer with a closed model. A lot of researchers want to have that, right? A lot of researchers want reproducibility. You can't really have that when you don't know what's behind that model router, behind that RESTful API that you're calling. And so I think that there's a bunch of reasons why I think open source like existentially needs to exist. But I don't see it as an either or. I think they both coexist, in my opinion.
And you want to compete exactly at this level, this frontier level, right? So like 1 trillion, 2 trillion, 6 trillion, whatever parameters, parameter models?
6 trillion, wow.
I've seen Musk saying something on Twitter about this. So like we're training a 6 trillion and a 10 trillion. I don't know if it's just Musk being Musk or if it's real, but yeah.
Our goal is definitely to be at the frontier. I think that our goal is to be on the open frontier and then obviously like lead in the ecosystem. It's a very capital intensive game, to play that, you know, to be there. We've raised a lot of money, probably nowhere near, you know, as we need to raise at this point, given, you know, what others have in the ecosystem. We're probably the most capitalized, you know, strongest, neo labs, I would say, in the ecosystem. But to be clear, we haven't shipped a model yet. You know, our models are still in development, but that is our goal. We have a great team. We have, we're well capitalized and we have a great path to monetization, which I think are the three ingredients you need to be successful, in the space. You know, in terms of parameter counts, I think that it is a bit of a red herring, to be honest, because I think ultimately, you know, a 6 trillion parameter model is incredibly difficult to deploy. And I've seen this firsthand. You know, when we shipped even the 405B, you know, model, the dense model, which, you know, I assume you're referring to like probably an MOE.
Yes.
But like,
yes.
you know, like, of course, like, the, you know, the 405B dense model was something, Yeah, when we were building that model, it was like we wanted to push as hard as we could with the compute we had and the most aggressive model. Yeah, and you know, when we actually started to work with the ecosystem, even internally at Meta at the time, like it was difficult to deploy, right? It required distributed inference. We actually had to shard the model across multiple systems, so it wouldn't fit within the memory space of an 8 GPU. At the time, it was Hopper, kind of H100 systems, you know. And so we went around to all of our ecosystem, you know, partners, the big hyperscalers, and we're like, hey, we have this model. It was trained in BFloat 16 numerics. And we're like, hey, can you guys deploy this? And they're like, no, we don't know how to like shard and do distributed inference at the time. Even like some of the top hyperscalers, which I won't name, really couldn't do it. So we ended up quantizing the model to, you know, float 8 numerics, so 8-bit numerics. And that fit within an 8 GPU system. But of course, you trade off some capabilities and you have to think about safety and you have to evaluate it all again and red team and so on. But ultimately, like this is one of those things where you will prove out capabilities at a larger parameter count. And then ultimately, you have to build the path to actually deploy this technology in different ways. Like at Meta, I was kind of like the unofficial kind of distillation edge small model guy at the company. Like I was the guy advocating strongly for the baby llama models that we released, the 1 and 3B models.
Thank you.
And they're still some of the most downloaded models. I was so happy we got those. Yeah. It was an absolute, you know, knife fight to get the compute to get those models out the door. Because you know, it's like where are you trading off? Like, do you put more compute at the bigger models, or do you start to distill to smaller models? And I think I was so proud that we got those out there because there were so many reasons for those to exist, whether it was safety or on device. And so I worked a lot with our Reality Labs team, you know, not only to define the kind of size and form factor of models, but also the numerics and also the hardware infrastructure that we build. Because when you deploy onto glasses, it's a very, very different world than deploying onto like NVIDIA GPUs in the cloud. A lot of it becomes very custom. There's compiler infrastructure you're building. There's kernels you're writing. The numerics might be very, you know, kind of integer based instead of floating point based. So there's a bunch of things that you actually need to build out just to even like deploy. The amount of work to get models onto those glasses was mind boggling. The amount of work that was done to get efficiencies so, you know, your face wouldn't be absolutely fried by having those models like running locally was absolutely, it was like a wonder of engineering, to do that. People don't really understand how much work it is to do that and how much true research needs to happen to actually get to that point. So, but back to your question, we are going to push obviously as hard as we can with the compute we have, and we'll build, the best, the most aggressive and most open frontier models we can, independent of the parameter count. But yes, we will be obviously building very large models.
And you recently had a deal with SpaceX AI, right, to use Colossus 2 as a data center, which I know it probably wasn't an easy decision. And you don't have to comment on that specifically, but we always joke that making partnerships with Elon Musk-owned properties is like their stories have unreliable narrators, and that could also be the case here, but you don't have to answer that. We can sidestep that. Just wanted to get that in. But what do you see the Colossus 2 partnership is going to bring and offer Reflection AI in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we have compute coming from all kinds of different sources, from neo clouds to big clouds to obviously the recent SpaceX deal. And I think, you know, it's a great partnership. We don't, you know, deal too much with Elon, which is good. But I think the infrastructure has been really stable. I think we've actually been pretty impressed with it. We were up and running on it very, very quickly. We were scaling up within a matter of hours and even a handful of days. Like we were actually scaling up some of our larger RL runs and some of our pre-training. So I think like overall the infrastructure is actually quite impressive. You know, for us, we're a neo lab, so we need as much compute as we can possibly get. We probably have a lot more compute than probably a lot of others. But the downside is, you know, it has to be from a lot of different sources, because you kind of get, you know, there's not, the compute world right now is like on fire. There's, you know, the market is really crazy. You go to Neo Labs, Neo Clouds, and they just don't have a lot of GPUs available. And, you know, what we need is a lot of contiguous GPUs to do things like pre-training and mid-training. And, you know, we can get away with like 10,000 here, 10,000 there, depending on what we're trying to do. But ultimately, we're in a compute constrained environment, even with the amount of GPUs we have, which is probably more than many. But yeah, the SpaceX deal was great. I think it's expensive, no question, to get those GPUs. The spend is higher than we want. But the compute is really helping us and actually allows us to accelerate a lot of the roadmap that we had, which I think was really beneficial to us. So yeah, I think so far so good there. But we have more compute partnerships to come for sure. So
I'll bet.
And say you're a country, because we're speaking a lot about open weights, about sovereignty even, and exactly because of this case that happened with Claude Fable, that the government of the US just decided from one day to the other, no non-American citizen can use this model.
Yep.
This can happen. And your whole company, tech company ecosystem can be plugged to that, like to Anthropic, to OpenAI, to Google, doesn't matter. And that's one of the importances, and that's why we promote here on the podcast on Yes Sob Controle, this idea of sovereignty, this idea of open models as well, like not only, but most as well, especially when you think about critic work and government work, things like that. But speaking specifically about governments, we are from Brazil, but I'm living in Spain, and I see like attempts to create things. Like here in Spain, we're trying to develop European models, like in European projects, with the whole European Union putting money into it. Brazil is a big country as well. But how about when you're talking about smaller countries, such as, I don't know, Ecuador, Rwanda, Thailand, doesn't matter. What do you think they should go for? Just like pre-train, mid-train, post-train, have the whole knowledge in-house for the future when these things become kind of like nuclear bombs, that they don't share the technology anymore?
Yeah.
Or just get some open weight models or open source models and fine tune on it?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting question, because it's, the technology is out there, and it's, I think what open source does is it does kind of like make everything available to everyone. I think, however, you need the capabilities to be able to leverage that technology. And I think there's still a lot of knowledge that, isn't available, or there's, capabilities that can't be leveraged because like there's more art than science still in some of these things. I mean, post-training is still one of those things where it is more art than science. We started the project, myself and Lysander over at Hugging Face. So we started a project called OpenEnv last year in October. We launched at the PyTorch conference, and the whole goal of that was really, to democratize reinforcement learning. And how do you actually allow anyone, frankly, any developer in the world to use RL and scale it up and post-train a model and actually customize for your use cases and your tasks. And that meant you needed, of course, environments. You needed, to different types of environments, depending on if you wanted, to make your models better at coding or shopping or whatever the use case you were targeting. You needed the tools to be able to leverage those. So there's like an ecosystem of tools like Verl and SkyRL and TRL from Hugging Face or Onslaught. You needed those tools to kind of be able to leverage those environments. And you just needed the recipes and the know-how, to be able to put all of that together and actually take an open weight model and actually improve it for your task. I think that part of this is that ecosystem is still relatively early stage, but it's growing quickly. We just announced that. I think hopefully you saw that maybe 2-3 weeks ago. Us and Hugging Face, we saw a number of others join the party. NVIDIA and Microsoft are joining and putting up pull requests, and we're seeing just incredible adoption there. And it's really starting to kind of truly even the playing field there. I think the other piece of it is, not every country kind of needs to build like an AI factory from land and power. Like I think you see like the bigger ones, like in Korea, yes, like they have a lot of money. They, they have, it's a larger economy. They can do that. I think what I'm trying to also do with reflection with our models is build all of the ecosystem layers on top of that as well. So you might, for example, like start with say like a NeoCloud or even leverage, like a hyperscaler or other providers that kind of like you don't need to manage all of the infrastructure, but you still get all of the benefits of customization and ownership of data and the governance pieces that you get, if you don't want to have to own your own data center and manage a full AI factory. So, like machine learning has always been about abstractions, like levels of abstraction. And I think the company, like I would say countries, sovereign countries can kind of choose, depending on the constraints they have, and their desired goals, you know, what abstraction level to kind of buy into. If they want to buy into the full enchilada, and like, you know, Brazil could, or because I mean, Brazil is a very sophisticated country, in my opinion, in that regard, or Korea, South Korea, like you can absolutely own it all and do that and be truly like sovereign or truly control everything. I think other countries can certainly leverage the ecosystem that is around us, though. If they want to build on, for example, like AWS, and we enable our partner, because we're going to be obviously very close partners with AWS or Dell, who's going to, you know, can deploy infrastructure on-prem, we will absolutely have that infrastructure in place or that ecosystem in place for another country to leverage. So I don't see this as like a, you know, as you got to go and do what other big countries are doing. You know, there are other options and still to be able to get the same kind of result as, say, someone like Korea.
You touched a little bit on it, but I wanted to make sure we have the time to talk about OpenEnv.
Yeah.
You said you're talking about how NVIDIA and Microsoft joined recently, and we shamefully have never talked about it here on the podcast. So we're going to correct this error today.
Cool.
Would you mind talking a little bit about what it is, what it intends to do, maybe results that the community has already been presenting?
Yeah, OpenEnv is a really, really cool project. I'm really proud of the way that ecosystem, I mean, that project literally started with a two-page doc that I wrote internally when I was at Meta with the problem statement of, you know, how do we actually, you know, leverage the flywheel of the ecosystem to generalize our models? And so when we were building Avocado, for example, and that model at Meta, we, you know, Joel Pobar and I sat down. Joel Pobar is still at Meta. He, you know, leads the kind of infra side over in MSL and in Meta Superintelligence Labs. And we saw, on one hand, we saw how every vendor environment, because, you know, as you know, like the last, what, year or so for environment vendors has just exploded. There's everyone's building environments, you know, McCore and Snorkel and Scale, and there's an environment explosion. And we saw basically that every vendor was doing something different. You know, every like API interface, every approach to like containerization, like they were slightly different. It required us to put a bunch of engineering behind trying to like standardize stuff. We also ran myself and a gentleman named Sanya Amhir. He's at Reflection now with me, previously with me at Meta. He and I ran a hackathon at the company across Meta, and we generated literally hundreds of environments in the company. And then we saw like what was happening kind of in the ecosystem around open source, and there was nothing tying it all together. And so my North Star was like, man, how do we like standardize the space so we can help, you know, build better models? That was, you know, the premise that I came out with. And it's funny, when I met with the Microsoft team a few weeks back, Govind and the team over there, they had the same exact like problem. They had their own, you know, kind of bespoke kind of golden environments they were building for things like computer use and so on, shopping. They were sourcing from vendors. You know, they had open source and none of these things fit together. And so we kind of sat down with that premise of, you know, how do we build this lingua franca, you know, with the goal of basically accelerating our models first and foremost, but really enabling an ecosystem to build on RL, which we then, of course, would draft off of. So, of course, there was a selfish reason why we did this. And it was definitely bearing fruit for us on the Meta side. But really what it enabled is the whole ecosystem to move faster. And really it democratized that, the use of RL or building with RL. And so what we saw very quickly is the kind of tooling ecosystem rallied quickly. So we saw SkyRL at Berkeley adopt it. That's Jan Stroika's lab over there. We saw, you know, the CoreWeave team, the ART folks. We saw, you know, basically like all the tools really started to adopt it, because they also were like, shoot, like, what is the way I interface with an environment? Like there's like the stuff that Prime Intellect was doing with Prime RL and their hub. And then there was stuff on Hugging Face. None of this stuff worked together. None of it interopt. And it was really, so that was like where we started. And I think, you know, we launched a PyTorch conference in San Francisco at Moscone. And, you know, we came out of the gate. We actually put that project together. We launched it in, I think, 5 or 6 weeks. Like we, with the idea like that we had and just like ran like hell and shipped it at PyTorch conference with a bunch of partners. Unsloth, Daniel over at Unsloth was a big part of that. Hugging Face obviously contributed a ton to it. You know, Ben over at Hugging Face is absolutely incredible. We've since moved the repo and everything out of Meta's repo, out of their org and into Hugging Face, but very neutral, like excessively neutral governance. Like we wanted to make sure that we just, in fact, I approved a pull request last night, you know, to move the license over to a true BSD3 license with neutral governance. And the project has really taken off. I think at this point we have probably like dozens of tools. that use it. We ourselves at Reflection for our own RL infrastructure are using it. We have, I think in the hub itself, I think there's maybe 4,500, or maybe even approaching 5,000 environments in there. And so when we looked at the project, it actually was really two parts though. It was a spec and a standard way to interface. So kind of a Jim style API with basically an opinionated Docker style container. And then there was the hub itself. And how do you kind of bridge those things, right? And so that was where we started. And I think at this point, you know, like I said, thousands of environments in the hub, dozens of tools, definitely most, if not all of the environment vendors are using it because frankly, it allows them to kind of standardize, to an environment spec very easily. And it's probably the best spec out there. And I would say one plug for my team is, you know, in India, about a month or maybe a month and a half ago, we ran a hackathon that was basically the world's largest hackathon on our own environments. I think we had in person, I think 2,000 people, and I think something like 40,000 people online or something. It was insane. And I think we'll probably try and beat that world record. And if you think about it, it's even crazier to think about something as like sort of esoteric, like reinforcement learning. It's like, you know, it was something simpler, like something more accessible, like we probably could have gone even crazier. But the fact that it was like something as crazy as like, you know, how can 40,000 people like want to jump in and do reinforcement learning? I have no idea, but they were there and they were online and stuff that came out of that hackathon was incredible. So
that's really, really cool. And we touched a little bit on PyTorch already, but I cannot prevent going deeper because it's one of the biggest success cases in open source of all time, I'd say, in AI frameworks especially. And in your opinion, what is something that PyTorch got right that other frameworks missed? And for someone that works with product or with technology and is thinking about releasing something similar in the future, not similar in this sense, but like a product that they want to be just as successful, how would you summarize the PyTorch playbook kind of for them?
Yeah, I was actually chatting with somebody about this yesterday. So this is pretty top of mind. I try and carry these tenets through a lot of what I do. But, you know, I remember, when I joined Facebook, I had worked with the team with Sumit and, you know, for years prior and a lot of the folks there prior, Yanqing. And, you know, when I came on board, we had this pretty fragmented ecosystem, even within Facebook. We had Cafe and Cafe 2, and we had, you know, kind of PyTorch was like less than, probably it was like maybe 10 people at the time over in Fair building it and very research centric. You know, there's like Adam Pashka and Sumit Sintala were kind of like the leading it along with a few others and very research centric though, like kind of very grassrootsy research. And then you had more production side of things. I think when I first joined, we were like, how do we consolidate? How do we build a common platform? How do we build something that we can take research to production? And because we had all of these production needs, we knew it was coming. Everyone was trying to deploy these models. And we had this disjoint ecosystem to be able to do that. One of the interesting things, we made a very conscious choice in how we actually built the project and how we actually took it to market, how we thought about the ecosystem. There was like a very clear decision point where, and it was actually, this was a pretty controversial thing, actually. Like there were a lot of heads being butted and like a lot of like, strong arguments and people not happy with each other. I won't name names to protect the innocent here, but, you know, we could have easily gone down the path of being very kind of like top down, like, hey, we have this PyTorch thing, go to every cloud, go to hardware vendors and say like, you know, please, oh, please go enable it. And kind of like sell it from a position of kind of weakness in that regard. You know, the other approach which was the one we took is we actually took a very kind of grassroots research centric approach to building it. We focused on training, which is what researchers cared about because it was all about time to getting, you know, some results, right? That's they didn't care about inference at the time at all. They cared about training, you know, on GPUs. How do I scale up and how do I get some kind of result quickly? How do I learn how good my model is very quickly? I want to iterate quickly. I want to express ideas very easily and get to results very quickly. That was like the premise we started with. And we knew research to production was going to be a thing. We knew that all of this goodness that was happening in the research community, in open source, in top labs, like say Berkeley and Stanford and NYU, the folks we were working with so closely with, we knew all of the goodness that was coming out of research was going to at some point make its way into products. How can you not take cutting edge computer vision, NLP, speech, like all these different modalities, all the work that was happening you knew people were going to build products on it. They were horizontal technologies that could be enabled in a lot of different applications. And so ultimately, we knew that was going to happen. However, we were laser focused on making sure the research community was building on us. Like that was like our absolute like P-1. And so, you know, the approach we took was like so radically different. The way we iterated in the early days was like absolutely wild. So like, for example, Andre Karpathy was one of our like closest collaborators. Jonathan Frankel was one of our closest collaborators. He's over at Databricks now, part of the Mosaic acquisition. And, you know, to earn trust with the community, we would actually they would give us feedback in chat, and within hours we'd have pull requests up, or we'd have a branch that they could test, right? And so the iteration time was like so fast, and it earned trust. And that's actually like where that original tweet came out of Andre, when he's like, you know, hey, I've been testing PyTorch for 6 months. My skin is clearer, right? The air smells fresher. Like that was kind of a meme that was in, it was like a niche thing in the research community at the time. No one really outside of the core research team or research ecosystem kind of like got it. But like, you know, that was pretty impactful for a lot. And that's what drew like OpenAI to go all in with us. And like, we were working with, you know, David Luan and Shulman and a bunch of folks over there, Tom Brown, in the earlier days. But like that choice for us to really focus, because we could have easily taken the opposite approach and said, okay, we're going to try an enterprise like Max and try and focus on enterprises with PyTorch. But that would have been kind of where TensorFlow was and hitting where they were and what their strengths were. And so we took the exact opposite approach. And I think that really was an important inflection point for what we did. I think the other thing that we did that I think was really impactful, and this is something that Sumith and I really, really like believed in deeply together. Like, I think we wanted the project to feel like it wasn't a Facebook product, like owned by Facebook or led by Facebook. And we went out of our way in a bunch of different ways to make sure the community felt like they had agency and ownership on the project. Whether that was having a persons of interest that had kind of module ownership at the project level that was very diverse. I mean, at some point we had, for example, like a gentleman named Peter JC123. He was a gentleman out of China. And he was like just an independent developer. And he was literally managing our Windows builds. I've never met him to this day, you know, a decade later. I've never met him in person. But I've, you know, have seen him on VCs and like chatted with him, and we worked with him on every release. And so we had this really strong, I would say, we had students. We had a guy named Simon from MIT. He was a PhD student. He was like managing a module on the project. And so we really went out of our way to make sure that there was like diverse ownership. It wasn't just our engineers at Facebook that were kind of owning it. There it is. Like, we built it, take it. No, that's not how we approached it. I think the other thing that we did that was really interesting is we actually almost put our own teams at a disadvantage internally. So PyTorch at the time, like when FAIR was releasing a lot of projects, they would release research, they wanted to release like new libraries, and they wanted to leverage the PyTorch name. And we actually didn't allow that. We actually, like, for example, like we would not allow them to like king make, like on, say they built an NLP library, which they did, we actually wouldn't allow them to king make the space. And we wanted basically everyone to be on an equal footing in the space. And I think that allowed there to be a lot of trust in the ecosystem in us. And like when something would go wrong like that, I mean, I got yelled at by the OpenNLP team at one point, and we immediately reversed course and addressed the situation and made sure that they felt like they were, you know, that they weren't at a disadvantage with either teams internally or anyone else. And whether that was branding or whether it was time to market. And so I think ultimately the project felt very much like it was in a foundation before it was in a foundation. And I think, and that was by design. That was absolutely by design. That was very intentional. Every day was a fight to make sure that that was the case. But it was a fight worth fighting. So,
do you think it could have succeeded without Facebook Meta?
I don't think so. I think this is one of those things that's, again, a bit of a like a paradox in this case. Like, I think, you know, we were in such, it was such an interesting dynamic. It was like the conditions were so unique that you had a company that was, you know, Jan LeCun was fantastic to work with. Like, he was very, very open. You know, while he focused a lot on the research, he was not involved a lot in PyTorch, but we obviously like, we worked with him a lot more generally. And he was such an advocate for us. And so was Shrep, our CTO at the time. And so the fact that we saw value in open source, and we were so, you know, you had folks like myself and Sumith really really had, I would say, a vision and really had an ethos and how we wanted to the project to kind of grow over the years. I think that fact was one piece. I think that we didn't have a cloud was another. The fact that we weren't out there trying to like leverage it to go and sell compute or try and drive a revenue product, I think was another. I think that there's also like the fact that a lot of what we were doing was a good proxy for, I would say, the broader ecosystem. Like we ourselves were very focused on like hardware heterogeneity. We wanted to support lots of different hardware. Like you can imagine basically, you know, a PyTorch being part of a hardware company, a silicon company. And then of course that PyTorch would be very centric on that hardware. And I think that's like bad for the ecosystem. I think we need diverse hardware support, not just on the cloud side, but, you know, on devices, on wearables. You know, I think it's good to have like neutral governance in a way that like you can kind of create a true like ecosystem and create and enable competition and all that. I think that was like a good thing. So I think the fact that we were able to fund it, you know, we were a well-capitalized company. We were a public company that had good products that generated a lot of revenue. So we could fund, for example, like CI. CI was expensive. You know, we were spending tens of millions of dollars a year on CI. In hindsight, it sounds like not a lot of money compared to where we are today, but still it was very expensive. And even to this day, actually, PyTorch Foundation and I think Meta probably today is still funding the majority of the CI along with NVIDIA and AWS and others. But CI was expensive. And so, you know, Meta or Facebook at the time, you know, putting that money up and supporting it. There was a lot of engineering that needs to happen, though. You know, developer infra level support, again, maintaining that CI. I think build and releases, like having high quality releases that are well tested across hardware. I don't think like that could have happened without having a company like Facebook at the time and having the ethos and all the infrastructure in place. I think to scale it up to the level that it really, the impact that it had in the ecosystem, I don't think it was possible without it. So
for my two last questions for you, one is very silly, the other one is serious, but the silly one is, since you brought up Avocado, why is that model called Avocado? Because I have a theory that it's a perfect description of LLMs. They take forever to become ripe, and they last for like a day, and then they're old, right? But why is it called Avocado?
I don't want to comment on naming on for Meta and Submeta. I mean, that name has kind of leaked out into the ecosystem. I mean, I think like Alex wanted fun names for the models, which I think is cool.
Right.
I think researchers have fun with naming. Naming is kind of like a weird, hard thing. We always joke that like naming is actually the hardest part of things, but yeah, I mean, I think like, you know, I think OpenAI's like model names have leaked out. Like, you know, I think Noam Brown, for example, who I worked with in FAIR, like named it the reasoning effort Strawberry, but that never, you know, he only alluded to it on social media. Like he never, I think, came out and said it, but I think we have fun with names. I think it's cool. I have no idea why they picked Avocado Japan, so.
Right. And my actual question for you, my last question for you is, looking ahead, what is exciting you? Not necessarily even tied to Reflection AI, but what do you look at? You go like, huh, this is interesting. We should keep an eye out for it and maybe scratch an itch down the road.
What's exciting for me? I mean, I think like, obviously I'm excited to release our models. I think they're going to be great. I think the ecosystem is going to love them. I think we are going to be humble. You know, there's a lot of great models out there, but we're excited about what we're building and what we're releasing. I think I'm pretty excited about kind of where the kind of agent ecosystem is going. Like, I think that there's, you know, the projects that are that like, you know, I've been super impressed with the communities like Hermes, for example, out of News Research. Like they went from, I think, you know, 100 to 200K stars. I think there's like 100 and something thousand people on their Discord at this point. So I think like I'm kind of really interested to see like where those communities like go. And we're going to be obviously there and partnering with them and working closely with a lot of those kind of folks. Building around our models and contributing directly to those, so I'm really kind of excited about how these communities are evolving. I think I'm also excited about maybe the community getting back down to the, like the lower levels of the stack. Like I think there's a bunch of things, you know. I think like a lot of like the new money AI people are kind of at the very kind of high level agentic layer, and they're, you know, building more application layers. But for the kind of OG kind of deep tech folks, maybe like myself and other folks. Like we're, you know, this is an area where there's just a lot of learnings up and down the stack that we've had the last 10 plus years. And so, you know, RL is a bit of a like homage back to that because RL is pretty complex. I think the kernel ecosystem is also really interesting. Like we built this, you know, Mark Seraphim, who's now at Core Automation, I worked really closely with him building the GPU mode community. And I think like that community has really caught fire, and people like who would have thought like developers would want to like write kernels or, you know, and see what happens. And that community has just absolutely caught fire. And I think it's really fun to see, because like these things, like, you know, if you're just developing at the agent layer, it's like you sort of don't see all of the things that happen underneath to enable what you're doing. And so I'm excited to kind of see resurgence in some of the lower levels of the stack, because I think that's what really ultimately drives like efficient inference, reinforcement learning, which ultimately allows you to customize and build new skills. And those layers matter. And I think we need people to learn those skills and actually be deep in the stack. I think it's good for them. It's good for their understanding. It's good for their knowledge. And honestly, like we need to hire more those people. So the more people get trained up on these things, you know, the more jobs are available for people to work on these things. So that's kind of what I'm excited about.
Completely agree. And my last question to you, Joe, is that you've advised a lot of companies about of AI startups, even and invested.
Yep.
In your opinion, now, July 2026, what are the startups that shouldn't exist anymore? Or they shouldn't, like someone with an idea that is listening to us, they shouldn't think about opening this because the market's already saturated, or they're going to be replaced by an AI model in 2 months. Mm-hmm. And what is the niche that is not saturated that they should look at?
I think where there's a lot happening right now is around kind of agent infra. I think that it's hard to see like all of those companies like long-term surviving, just because there's so many of them. I think environments as well is an area where I think it's a hard market. It's kind of like the data annotation market. So I think that's another area where I think that you probably are going to see some like breakouts, you know, that are there. I think it's like a low barrier to entry, but it's also a market that has like, there's only so many, you know, frontier labs that they can work with. I still think we haven't solved like customization. And I think like full stack customization, I think that there's one startup that is not public right now that I'm advising. And they're thinking about like not only the harness layer and kind of the agentic layer, but how the overall agent can evolve over time and how it can improve. And that incorporates, for example, like, you know, customization, even at the model layer. So I think like, I don't think we saw that is very much still an art, not a science. And so I think the company that is able to solve that and build to an abstraction that truly enables a lot of others to build on it. Like, I think Tinker is a cool product, but it's a very research centric API, and it's very cool, but it's not something that is like kind of built for kind of the broader ecosystem or even like easy for enterprises to adopt. Cause there's still a very fair amount of like tribal knowledge, I think, required to use it. So I think whoever kind of cracks that, I think is going to be, I think that'll be really interesting. So I'm making some bets. They're not public yet, but hopefully you'll see soon. So
nice.
Awesome. Joe, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. If folks maybe want to continue this conversation with you, maybe send in a resume, where should I go?
Maybe they can follow me on LinkedIn. They can also, you know, my DMs are open. Like if you want to send me or reply, obviously, to Reflection, we have a job. We're hiring a ton of roles right now. So that's probably the easiest. But of course, like follow me. I post a lot on LinkedIn. I stay off of X mostly, but I'm definitely on LinkedIn a lot. So.
Maravilha. Os links vão estar na descrição do episódio. E para você que ainda não garantiu o seu lugar no IA Conference Brasil 2026, vai ter na descrição do episódio também o link para você dar uma espiadinha em todo mundo que já está confirmado e confirmada para ensinar horrores para vocês todos e todas, para mim, para o Fabrício também. Fabrício vai estar no palco e depois assistindo também as palestras no dia 24 de setembro no Centro de Convenções Frei Caneca, em São Paulo. Lembrando que, dando uma espiadinha aqui na lista que está no link na descrição, se você for no LinkedIn do pessoal que está confirmado, pedir o cupom de desconto, eles dão para você o cupom para você aproveitar um desconto e garantir seu lugar antes que vire o lote, fique mais caro. Vai ser muito bacana poder aprender junto com todo mundo, ainda mais sobre para onde esse mercado está apontando, para onde ele vai, como tirar proveito disso a partir de já. Então, 24 de setembro, Centro de Convenções Frei Caneca e a Conference Brasil 2026, não perca. E eu e o Fabrício voltaremos no episódio de sexta-feira, que provavelmente vai ser um pouquinho diferente do que a gente está acostumado. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.